Blueberry is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Newberry to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Pat Hartwell. Houston Vigil reporter, Jennifer Simmons. The Execution Watch for Donald Newberry begins.
Good evening, this is Ray Hill. This is a live broadcast of Execution Watch from the studios, broadcast studios of radio station KPFT Houston. I am, along with our producer Elizabeth Stein, co-founder of this show, we do this show only when someone is being executed in Texas prison. And that means that we preempt the regularly broadcast programs on radio station KPFT. Tonight's preemption is from Border Radio, but you can find it if you are tuning in to hear Border Radio. You can find Border Radio on KPFT's HD3 channel, and if you don't have that kind of equipment, you can go to the internet, dial www.kpft.org, and you will find HD3 channel being streamed live on that website. I was in Livingston today. Mark Pirtle and Elizabeth Stein and I went up to interview Lester Bauer and Rodney Reed. And we had two good interviews with some wonderful people. I enjoyed both of them. Lester and I are old friends. He listens to the show and he's listening now. Hi, Lester. Rodney, I hope you could finagle access the radio so that you can hear it as well. And hello, guys on death row. When we're on broadcast, KPFT's repeater, 90.3 FM in Livingston, Texas, carries the signal with a greater clarity than many of you can get it on 90.1 down here in Houston. Donald Newberry is about to be executed. Could you put Pat on?
Pat's here.
Hello, Pat. What's going on?
Well, seven witnesses have just walked across. We know that the Supreme Court denied him about, 10 or 15 minutes ago, and so the witnesses have walked across.
And so what does that mean to the listeners of Execution Watch?
That means that the execution is going to proceed.
They don't take witnesses across the road until the person scheduled to be executed is strapped down, needles in place, and everything is prep is done so it's ready.
Yes, that's correct. When the witnesses get in there, he will already have IVs in both arms and the sheet will be up on him. And as soon as they get in, they'll open the curtains and the microphone will go down for his last words.
How many folks you got up to Huntsville?
We got about 25 tonight. What is encouraging, we have two wives and one mother and one pen pal of the guys on death row, and that's very encouraging to us when they give of themselves to come out and show solidarity.
Good point, Pat. All right, you sit tight. Let us know if anything happens after this.
Okay, if we can hear you over the police escort that they brought up here with their motorcycle gang.
That's right. There's a counter demonstration, too.
Oh, yes, there always is when an officer is killed. And every time that they think something's going correct on their way, they'll rev up those motorcycles to let us hear.
Okay, you know how to call in and give us information.
Okay, I will. Thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Pat. Pat Hartwell is standing vigil in Huntsville for that purposes. And let's see, we're supposed to have Jennifer Simmons. Jennifer's not in yet, so we're trying to reach Jennifer Simmons. In the meantime, Jim, what happened in this case?
We've gone over this case before. What happened about 14 years ago, seven inmates broke out of what they call a maximum security unit down in South Texas. It was a John B. Connolly prison system. And it was in the middle of the day. In fact, they drove away in a maintenance truck away from the prison. And they go to a little town called Kennedy where a car had been waiting there left for them, and then from there they'd take off. These seven stay together. They end up going eventually to Pearland, in which they go to Pearland, and they end up robbing at 2 in the morning. They break into a Radio Shack, break into a computer store. In fact, they drag the safe out of the Radio Shack and scarred up the parking lot to get money. Broke into there, and then they end up in San Antonio for a while. Then they end up in Farmers Branch up in north around Dallas. And they decide on Christmas Eve, and the prison break took place on the 13th. So this is Christmas Eve on the 24th. They've been on the lam quite a while. In the meantime, of course, there's all the publicity, all the newspaper, and they call them the Texas Seven. They nicknamed them the Texas Seven as the largest jailbreak that they claim had occurred. And so what they decided to do was to rob an Oshman store about the time it was closing. So they go in the Oshman store, and they're robbing the place, and somebody calls the police, and one local policeman shows up. It's a gentleman who'd been on the force about 8 years, been in law enforcement about 8 years. He was a 29-year-old man named Aubrey Hawkins. He comes up by himself, and during the robbery, he didn't ask for backup. He just drives up. When they drives up, basically, they ambush him. He gets shot something like 11 times. And then in the process of escaping, the Texas Seven, as they're called, ran over his body, whether it's accidentally or intentionally, nobody really knows. And while they were in Oshman's, they stole like 44 rifles, a bunch of ammunition, as well as money and things.
Mercy.
And so from that point, they still are not caught, and they all still stay together, which is really unusual. And they end up getting an RV and driving up to Colorado. And they end up in an RV park at a little town in Colorado, outside of Colorado Springs. And they stay there for a while and kind of blend in with everybody. In fact, one of them had been involved in some church services and was well-liked. And then, lo and behold, they'd been there for several weeks, and some gentlemen saw knew they were living there, and they were kind of curious about them, and they saw the program that America's Most Wanted and recognized the guys as being the 17 escaped from prison. They still were all together. And so at that point, he notifies the owner of the park. They in turn notify the police. The police show up, and they eventually capture all of them. They capture some of them there, capture some at a motel. And what happened, all seven people were captured, and one of the young men that was involved, a kid named Larry Harper, commits suicide, so there's six left. All six are tried for capital murder of the police officer. All six have received the death penalty. The first one to be executed in this group was a man by the name of Michael Rodriguez. He was from San Antonio. It was really the interesting case. When he died, he was one of the few that said, "I want all my appeals over with." What he had done, he ended up being in prison for killing his wife.
Mm-hmm.
He had picked up a girlfriend while going to school and hired someone to kill his wife. And what he said, it's real simple. He said, "I killed my wife, and I shouldn't have done it. I've lived a life of crime. I escaped and involved in killing a policeman. I want all my appeals over with." And he was the first one to be executed. Then after that, the second one to be executed was a man named George Rivas, and he was considered the mastermind. He was the one that put this escape together, because the escape is pretty well planned, because like I say, they drove away.
Well, apparently.
They drove away in broad daylight.
In a pickup truck.
With seven guys in it.
With prison insignia on the door.
Absolutely amazing. And they drive away, and they stay out for almost a month and a half with all the publicity all over the country about them. And they stay out of prison. And those two have been executed. And this young man, where he was captured when they raided the RV park, he and another one of the escapees were in a motel. And so they had that standoff they typically see and hear about where SWAT team comes out. And he agreed to voluntary surrender if it could be interviewed by television. So they sent in a TV crew, and they interviewed him, and he surrendered, and he's the one that's being executed tonight. And he's 50-something years old, and he's the third one of this group that's going to be executed. And there are, of course, six of them total that survived it. You've got four more to go, and it's going to be the same thing with them, too. And what's been interesting, at least from a law viewpoint, The courts didn't give much consideration. This is the third time they've heard this series of cases. They didn't kill many trees in writing their opinions. Yeah. They didn't do much. They just, and the Supreme Court, for example, today, it was about one sentence. Judge Scalia got the request for a stay of execution. He referred it to the full court, and they denied it. That's kind of like all they've ever said about this case. And he's, like I say, he's the third one of this group that involved in this prison escape that's going to be executed, and the rest of them are on death row awaiting their turn. And that's basically it.
Okay. Is there anything peculiar about the trial of Don? These people were tried all together or tried separately?
Tried separately.
You
tried
have to be tried separately.
Right, in the capital case, you'd have to. Yeah, they were all tried separately.
There's no way you can bulk execute. You've got to do it one
Not time, unless you live in Iraq.
In Iraq, yeah.
But not here yet.
Not here yet. It's got to have one at a time. Anything unusual about the trial?
The only thing unusual about the trial is Larry's going to discuss why they didn't request a change of venue. And one of the things that really needs to be explained to the listening audience, one of the things that Larry Newberry said in his prison interview before he surrendered, he was pretty outraged because he got a 99-year sentence on a robbery case, and he was complaining that long sentences and prison conditions. As a matter of fact, he said the people that run the prison are bigger crooks than we are.
Well, it's probably true.
Could be true.
Some evidence of that.
Down that way, it might have been. Yeah. But I'll ask Susan to try to explain why it was a 99-year sentence on a robbery from Travis County, which is pretty liberal, but she'll explain why it was 99 years.
Okay. We haven't heard from Jennifer Simmons, who is at the Houston demonstration, and when we hear from her, we're going to interrupt. But in the meantime, Susan, take it away.
Mr. Newberry had in the early 80s, he was charged with an aggravated robbery. He got a 10-year sentence on that. He was released on mandatory supervision.
Wasn't that out of Travis County, too? Was it Susan?
Yeah, I think they're all Travis
County. Right, so I'm just going to say.
He was released on mandatory supervision. He was released in July of 85 on mandatory supervision. Now, at that time, he probably didn't do a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
So while he was on mandatory supervision, he got charged with another aggravated robbery. That robbery, of course, caused his mandatory supervision to be revoked. He pled guilty, I believe, to 15 years, got 15 years TDC. His previous mandatory supervision was revoked in April of 87, and that's when he got 15 years on the second robbery. Then he was released again on mandatory supervision in March of 92. So he was on mandatory supervision when he got the third aggravated robbery, and that was in May of 98. And in May of 98, on the third aggravated robbery, he got a 99-year sentence.
What's the difference in robbery and aggravated robbery? Did you explain that?
Well, aggravated would be affirmative finding of a deadly weapon.
So he was using a firearm during the robberies.
Yeah. And so I would imagine the aggravated robbery that he got the 99-year sentence, he would, of course, been enhanced with the two previous robberies. That would have given him a 25-year minimum. And then, of course, it would be 25 to life.
And then, as we discussed before, in that third robbery, all the evidence of the two robberies would come in, too, wouldn't it, Susan?
Right. The charging instrument in the third robbery would contain the convictions that he was once before convicted of an aggravated robbery, the dates, the times of the convictions.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt. We hear from Jennifer. Go ahead and put Jennifer on the phone. Hello, Jennifer.
Oh, hi, Ray. We are out here.
Where is here?
Well, we're in front of St. Stephen's Episcopal Church in Montrose, West Alabama at Woodhead.
Okay, you got many folks?
Well, we have six very strong women here. Last week we had a smaller group, but we do have six all women here today and very good advocates.
All right, well, we got a call from Pat Hartwell in Huntsville, and the witness is across the road, so that means that the process has begun. And we are talking about the case, awaiting word from her that the process has been completed, and that's the next news we'll have from Huntsville. Could you You are active with Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty?
That is right, tcadp.org. And our prayers and thoughts go out to everyone on Texas Death Row tonight. We know it's very difficult when they see friend after friend leave and be executed. So thoughts and prayers to everyone there in Polanski and also their family members, crime victims, and their suffering too. So.
We're on broadcast tonight, so fellas on the row can hear us. And so
okay. I know.
And our good friend, who usually is in the position you're in, Dave Atwood, is attending very serious family business. Priscilla's not been well.
Right.
And thank you very much for doing this. And
okay.
Give our regards to the other vigilants.
We will, Ray, and we'll see you later and keep on going.
Thank you, ma'am.
Bye-bye.
All right. Now, Susan, we can continue.
Well, when he was charged with the robbery that he got 99 years on, he would be enhanced with the two prior robberies and two prior trips to TDC.
So this is what you call the Chuck Hurt Rule. You don't go to prison for what you do. You go to prison because they get tired of screwing around with you. And he accumulated enough cases that was the big number.
Well, his two prior enhancements would give him a 25-year minimum. Now, typically, prosecutors with a 25-year minimum, you know, depending on the facts of the robbery, prosecutors are not going to offer 99 years. They would typically offer, you know, something maybe from 20 to 45 years. That would be.
But he didn't cop a plea.
Well, he got a jury trial.
Yeah.
He got 99 from a jury because prosecutors aren't going to offer you 99 and people, you know what I mean, on a robbery, it wouldn't make sense.
So chances are very good. Do we know for sure that he turned down a better offer to get 99 from the jury?
We don't know for sure what the state offered. The state has the option of making an offer. The state also has the option of saying we offer nothing.
And don't forget, too, he had some time to serve on that other robbery he had been paroled on. So right. A lot of that depends on how much time he had left and what the offer would be. Because if he got a bunch of time on that second robbery he's on parole on, that would affect what kind of offer the state would make.
So basically, whatever the circumstances were, he worked himself in a situation where he had little hope of ever getting out.
That's exactly right.
The state would, you know, the state's not going to offer 99. You know, that wouldn't make any sense. The state would make some, shall we say, far less offer. And then, of course, the state could, if they wanted to, say we offer nothing and you go to trial. But I would tend to doubt that was the case.
Now, as I recall, Rivas had a lot of time.
He had 18 consecutive life sentences.
18
consecutive, which means he had to serve 18.
Is that even a legal sentence?
Well, it, apparently so. But I had 18 of them. That means if he had to live 18 different lives and he came back 17th time, he'd go to prison. 18 consecutive sentences stacked, life sentences.
And is everyone in this case?
Everyone, and Jackson, we discussed that. Everyone in this case, with the exception of the kid who committed suicide, had sentences of 50 years or more. All of them did.
Okay.
So once in a while, the state may say, we're not going to waive jury, which really means they're offering nothing, but I would tend to doubt that happened in
Travis
this case.
County probably didn't.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't happen very often. So he went to trial. I guess the jury gave him 99. He got the maximum sentence on the offense. And so he had a long sentence. It was an aggravated robbery. There would be an affirmative finding of a deadly weapon. He's sentenced in 98, so he would have to do, he would at least have to do half his time, at the very minimum.
And what they normally do, you can't, half 99, what they normally do, a life sentence and a 99-year sentence is considered a 60-year sentence, so you have to do probably 30 flat for it to even be considered for parole somewhere in that neighborhood.
Yeah, all sentences over 60 years are treated
as 60 years. Yeah, all treated as 60-year sentence.
Now, is that affected by sentences that are consecutive?
No.
Is that only
it's consecutive because what happens is consecutive. When you parole, you're eligible for parole on that one, then you start serving your other one. So you have 18.
So operationally, that don't work.
That's right.
I mean, if you're 38 years old at the time of the offense, I mean, if you add 30 years to that, that would make you 68.
That's before you're eligible, and there's no guarantee you'd get in.
Right. I mean, yeah. So.
Hope has been squandered.
Effectively, even under the best possible math and scenario, which is, you know, I mean, problematic, somebody could conceivably get out of prison when they're pushing 70.
Well, I mean, I think about going back sometime, but 75, I don't have enough time left for him to enjoy me.
I mean, I'm just saying, so effectively it was a life sentence. I mean, as a practical matter, you could say it was, the 99 was a life sentence.
At least it apparently was in his mind, enough
sure.
to think that escape was a viable option for him and his friend.
Yeah, and that's...
Okay, what's next?
Larry's going to talk about the... Remember I mentioned all the publicity in this case?
An enormous amount of publicity.
Larry's going to talk about... It was tried... Remember, this little town, it was... The Irving's in Dallas County. It was tried in Dallas County. And there was no request for a change of venue. And I want Larry to discuss change of venues and what you normally would do in the bed, how you handle a case involving so much publicity.
Okay. Hello, Larry.
Yeah, Ray. And as Jim mentioned, there's no indication that there was a motion for change of venue filed at all in this case. There was a tremendous amount of publicity, which suggests that the possibility of filing a motion for change of venue might have been a good thing to do for the defendant. Now, when a case is, when an offense occurs in a county, the presumption is that the trial is handled in that county, unless there is a reason to move it. And certainly the negative publicity would have been a good reason to move. The change of venue can be done either by the judge's own motion, or by the prosecutor, or by the defendant. If the defendant wants to request a change of venue, and again, there was no indication that he requested one in this case, he has to pretty much show that. Well, first of all, if they can agree, then the judge and the prosecutor and the defense lawyer just agree to move the trial to another county, in which case, in any case, if it's moved, then the election is made. Either the judge in the county where the offense occurred would either go with it with a trial, or have the visiting judge and have a judge in that county where the case ends up handle the case.
And that would usually be a visiting judge. It's rare for a resident judge sitting on a bench in an individual county that catches a change of venue actually.
But especially for something like
that. It makes a difference, Ray. If it's a nice venue, the judge always goes with. If it's Galveston or someplace, they can get signed, the visiting judge. I mean, the local judge always goes because the county gives them a free vacation.
Oh, okay.
But the good thing about...
I didn't know that part.
Yeah. Well, for example, we have a change of venue on a case out of Montgomery County to Galveston County. And Galveston is a lot more fun than Conroe, so Kathleen Hamilton goes with it. She gets per diem pay and gets a paid vacation for her.
Oh, okay.
And really, in order to get the change of venue, if the defendant wants one, he has to pretty much show that he cannot get an impartial trial, cannot get a fair jury pool in the county where the incident occurred. Now, there was a tremendous amount of notoriety about this case. I mean, it was right around the Christmas holiday time. There was the constant news coverage.
No, that was enormous. The thing I worry about change of venue is, even though this is Dallas, Irving is a neighbor of Dallas, a
right.
small town.
In Dallas County.
In Dallas County. It's a small town. Dallas County ain't as big as Harris County. It's you know, city takes up most of it, but there are suburbs that are within it. But it's not a hometown cop like a Dallas cop would be. And I don't think there was any less publicity about this case in Houston than it was in Dallas or in Beaumont or anywhere else, because this was a national story.
Well, but the other reason for wanting the change of venue, or at least moving for one, is that one of the greatest assets the defense lawyer has in these kinds of cases is creating reversible error. So if you don't ask for it and they don't give it to you, there's no error in that.
Okay.
But if you ask for it and they don't give it to you, then there's a possibility that you can raise the error that, well, there was just so much negative publicity that I could not have gotten a fair trial. The other thing is you can request a change of venue both on a pretrial motion, yeah, where you just file the affidavit of the defendant and then at least two other affidavits, probably a whole lot more, saying that he could not get a fair trial. I couldn't get a fair trial here. And upstanding citizens say, you know, I've heard enough about this. There's so much publicity that the person could not get a fair trial. You can also ask it, as Mike Gillespie is going to talk about later, during the jury selection process, because if the judge denies you the motion to for the change of venue in addition to the potential reversible error, you can also try again to see if there's some way to seat an impartial jury by asking the questions that can't be rehabilitated. Mike's going to talk about it in a minute. But again, this was right around the Christmas time, the escape being I think December 11th.
Yeah,
the killing of Officer Aubrey Hawkins was on Christmas Eve. Okay, so you're in Dallas County killing a police officer in Dallas County on Christmas Eve, and everybody knows about it.
Yeah.
But then there's so much so many other acts occurring all over the state of Texas and even going outside the state to Colorado. Could they have found an impartial jury anywhere in Texas or anywhere, any place other? I mean, these guys were known as the Texas
Seven. Well, even if you found an impartial jury, what are your chances of getting a not guilty verdict or getting something other than the death penalty?
It's just wearing them down, Ray.
Okay, now, while you're here, we're talking about these voir dire process and these veneries and venerians or whatever you call them. They are qualified to give the death penalty, or they don't get seated.
Each juror has to be death qualified in order to serve on the jury. And in order to serve on any jury, you've got to agree that you will follow the law in an appropriate case. And the law, as it applies to death penalty cases, is you'll have to at least agree to consider the death penalty if you deem the case to be appropriate.
Okay.
So yes, they do have to be qualified.
I don't have to be in favor of death penalty in a traffic court, but I have to agree to follow the law.
You have to follow the law in any trial that you sit on.
But in a capital case, that means I am asked if I'm capable of giving the death penalty.
Part of the law is that you would be willing to consider the full range of punishment, which includes the imposition of the ultimate punishment.
I think we have news from Huntsville. Hello, Pat.
Yes, Ray. The witnesses are just now walking out.
So
the execution is over.
Donald Newberry is now dead.
Yes, he is.
Among the witnesses, does he have family? Could you tell?
Unfortunately, we had someone in the visiting room yesterday, and the only person that went to visit Mr. Newberry was a prison clergy person.
Okay.
We understand that they brought him to the walls last night instead of today. So he has been here all alone all day long.
All alone all day long. And because no one was to see him at the visit room in Livingston.
Well, also, no one was to see him, plus him being one of the infamous Texas Seven, that I believe they brought him over for security.
Okay, Pat, thank you very much for calling.
Unfortunately, we'll see you next week also.
Well, I talked to Lester today. I've got some hope Lester will get a stay, but we'll see.
I sure hope so. He's an innocent person.
Always hope for a stay.
Yes.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you, Ray. Bye-bye.
Now I'm going to talk to the audience here just a second, because normally Donald Newberry did not have any family visit his execution. But normally, if family members do visit the execution and someone is killed in Huntsville, Texas, the contractor who removes the body, once he's dead, TDCJ is not interested in keeping him on the count. They have a contractor come in and take him away. Takes that body to a small chapel not far from the walls where the family can visit and touch the body while it is still warm. There's no reason to do that in Donald Newberry's case because he did not have any family present for his execution. I know that sounds awfully morbid, But if you were listening to National Public Radio this morning, they had an extensive story about the importance of touch in children who are raised in orphanages and do not enjoy it and all that. And there's something about human touch, especially family members touching and feeling the warmth of other family members, that kind of makes that morbid thing sound reasonably normal. Donald Newberry is dead. He has died in the course of our discussion on this show. That is unfortunately the nature of this show. And now, Larry, had you anything to wrap up on?
Well, the other thing, Jim, in addition to, I mean, we're not necessarily criticizing the lawyers for not filing a motion to change venue, but you never know what's going to happen.
You would have if this had been your case.
It would have seemed to be the appropriate thing to do, because you never know what's going to happen. And there have been some notorious cases in the past. I mean, that have moved, say, from, for instance, the Eroy Brown case.
Oh, yeah.
From Walker County down to Galveston County. Where Eroy Brown killed a warden.
One of my first cousins, actually. Killed Billy Max Morris, first cousin of mine.
Yeah, but Galveston County, I mean, Robert Durst cut a man's head off.
I know.
And so you never know what's going to happen. In addition to the possibility of reversible error, the possibility of getting a sympathetic jury who might do something different than might have happened in Dallas County, in whatever county that the case is decided in.
Now,
there's a risk, though, because you might end up in some county that you might not really
might
want to be
in. New Braunfels, and they all come in wearing swastikas.
Exactly. Well, you never know what you're going to get, but asking for it is at least raises the possibility of having some sort of reversible error. And that would have been one reason for asking for it. And also,
that would have probably, in this case, meant more delays.
More delays is for a person who's facing the death penalty is not necessarily a bad thing.
Okay. Susan, you want to add to this thing?
There would be a number of counties in Texas, if you did ask for a change of venue, that probably wouldn't help it make it worse. You wouldn't want to go to Harris County or Dallas County or San Antonio or Travis County, or
Mike, you're up.
Or El Paso or Brazoria, because there was some...
Of the prison employee situation.
No.
The prison employee situation is big in this case because these are, after all, escapees.
Well, that would be Walker County. Yeah. We'll add that in, too.
Well, Walker, yeah.
But I'm saying, like, the store robbed in Brazoria County, which is Perleon, I believe.
Yeah.
I believe Perleon is Brazoria.
Yeah.
In El Paso. So none of those counties, I don't think, would improve it.
Okay, Mike, what you got?
My job is to talk about jury selection. This is a case, as Larry talked about, there was a lot of adverse publicity. The question is how to handle adverse publicity if you don't get a change of venue and you have to try the case in front of jurors who have heard a lot about the case in the news media. When jurors come into a courtroom, they're obligated to follow the evidence presented in court and the law presented to them. If they've heard hearsay, it's not permitted in court.
Mm-hmm.
If they hear hearsay information through the news media, that's okay as long as it doesn't affect their opinion. The critical point of this is whether or not that hearsay information that they heard outside of the courtroom is enough to have a conclusion in their mind that affects their opinion.
Before the trial starts.
It really affects their verdict. They can have an opinion, as long as that opinion doesn't affect the verdict. The key is that you can't let your opinion affect the verdict. You've got to let your verdict be based upon the evidence and not what you've formed an opinion by reading. It's a verdict that really is critical.
The way this man attacked it on the appellate level is that the way the system works is that in a capital case, in most trials, all the questions that the lawyers ask the jurors are asked face-to-face. In a capital case, they're allowed to submit questionnaires. These are questionnaires that are asked of the jurors individually, and they may answer privately so that the attorneys may make a decision on whether or not to use this juror. These are questions that are presented to the court by both lawyers. both lawyers have to be in agreement with the questions, and any dispute, the judge resolves the questions. These questions are submitted to the juries. The main reason that's done is the interest of time, number one, and number two, a lot of questions, you get a better answer when it's not face-to-face. Asking somebody their political preference, their religious preferences, sometimes it's easier to have just a questionnaire to answer those questions to you. So that's what they did in this case, and that was allowed. What was not allowed, in my opinion, is that they put in there the law. And they put in there the law about what we're talking about right now, about jurors. The law is real clear. The law says that if a juror has already formed an opinion as to the guilt that would influence his actions in rendering a verdict, he's disqualified. That's the question. That's the question that's asked. What this man wanted was that question submitted to the jury. Instead, what the judge submitted was that question and also the way to rehabilitate that question and be a juror, even if you have an opinion. Because the next part of that test is that if you state in court that you have an opinion about guilt or innocence that would influence the actions, you should be automatically disqualified. There's a second part of that test to rehabilitate somebody where they can say they can set that opinion aside and follow the law. That should not have been put in the questionnaires. That's a way for jurors to understand the end game and get out of being on the juror.
Uh-huh.
Or to get on the jury if they want to give a death penalty.
Yeah, or even worse, get on the jury if they want to.
Like that old girlfriend of mine that says I was looking so forward to convicting somebody.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mike, you try cases.
Yes.
You pick jurors.
Yes.
Do you actually think there would be a realistic expectation of picking a jury that was qualified for death that wouldn't use it in this case?
That's a very difficult question because of the prior background and the facts.
Now, as a lawyer, it's your responsibility to try to do that, isn't it?
As a lawyer, that's your responsibility to try to do that.
And so you have to assess a bunch of different elements.
And you have to make the right decision that'll give your client the best objective.
And you have to look over that jury panel and say, you know, can I find a friend in this hostile environment?
Which is where the questionnaires come in to enable you to find out about some people without asking direct questions that might make them be offended by you.
Now, with that question being on the questionnaire as opposed to something as action on your part as a lawyer in the courtroom, does that diminish your ability to draw conclusions about a jury?
I think if the question was asked properly, would your opinion affect your verdict? The answer takes you off the juror. There's no place to go after that. It does not take legal skills to get somebody off who admits he's got an opinion that would affect his verdict. Everything else is a way to get that man on the juror when he wants to be on the juror.
And there's not a lot of argument today in Jordan about killing of two prisoners after watching the young Air Force air pilot get burned to death in that ISIS film. And so the whole, there's not a neutral mind in Jordan. You can't try that case in Jordan. So you may as well go ahead and kill him because you're not going to be able to do an alternative by any other means.
That's exactly why we have these laws in effect. That's exactly why you're supposed to be struck if you have that opinion. And the way that question was phrased, it gave people the way to get out of it. If you have an opinion that would affect your verdict, you are not allowed to be on that jury, on that jury panel.
See, this is, I think, one of these things that we have is absolutely hypocritical. Let me give you an example. There's a famous case called Witherspoon. It's a death penalty case. And what it basically says, if I'm called for jury service and I tell the prosecutor and the judge that I have a conscientious feeling against the death penalty, I can never assess it, that doesn't disqualify me. I've got to say that opinion will affect my verdict. Well, how in the world can it not affect your verdict? Because what they do, they call people in, they've read about this case, and if a juror says, yes, I've read about it, I think he's guilty. From what I've read, I'd probably give the death penalty. Well, that's my opinion. But then what I've got to say that opinion doesn't affect my verdict. That's stupid. That opinion is going to affect your verdict, and that's one of those judicial Houdini things that's absolutely absurd, because how can your opinion, when you're thinking about something, not affect your verdict? I mean, it's stupid, because part of what your verdict is rendered on your life experiences and your feeling. You've already said, I have an opinion he's guilty. I think he ought to die. But that's not going to affect my verdict. That is stupid. And that's one of those magic things that we ask people to do, which is just insane.
That's why you have a wizard hat.
Well, that's just absolutely absurd to say, I have an opinion. I think the guy is guilty. I think he should get the death penalty. But no. That's not going to affect how I interpret the facts of this case. Are you crazy?
Yeah.
I mean, that's absurd.
Well, can a system be devised where...
I think if somebody says, I have an opinion, my opinion is he's guilty of it, then he should be disqualified and not serve on the jury.
So instead of having jurors and venerees and people from jury panels and all that, we should have tried by judges who do not read newspapers or what's...
Well, if they read it and form an opinion they think is guilty, they ought to be kicked off the jury.
How about out of the bench?
Most of them should be kicked off the bench, right?
Anyway,
that's
right.
A big broad hey,
Jack,
brush.
How are you?
Have you been working on something here?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about the long sentences and what kind of an impact that had on this case.
Well, I've got other uses for you in here. We're also going to talk about why did these guys stay together after they left. But go ahead with what you came prepared to talk about.
All right. George Rivas when they escaped, George Rivas was serving 18 consecutive 15-to-life sentences.
He was the mastermind.
Yes. Michael Rodriguez, at 38, was serving 99 to life. Larry Harper, at 37, Joseph Garcia, Patrick Murphy, 39, they were all serving 50-year sentences. Donald Newberry, who recently was executed just now, was serving a 99-year life, 99-year sentence. Randy Halperin, 23, was serving a 30-year sentence. The only person here in this group who had any hope of having a few productive years of their lives after they got out of prison,
yeah,
was really Randy Halperin. He might have gotten out, I don't know if his 30-year sentence was probably aggravated, which means he at earliest, he would have gotten out, 38?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you have a long prison sentence for these folks, it makes us in society feel good about, boy, we really punished them properly. The defendants who are... sentence, the convicts, they really have nothing to look forward to. Their life is effectively over. They are going to be in prison. If they will either die in prison or they will leave a very, very old man out of prison. And it's when a convict has few to no options left, they come up with ideas. They start daydreaming. They start daydreaming and start thinking about, boy, what could I do to possibly salvage my life? Because it's not like are they going to give me another life sentence? Well, I already have 18. What are you going to do to me? So the problem that you run into here is when you've got somebody who has nothing left to lose, what do you take from them? They start to do things that...
You know, of course, the remaining defendants in this case sitting on death row, and there are three of them that remain, are listening to us.
Sure.
You know that they're out there listening to us.
Oh,
now
yeah.
They have even less to lose than they had to lose when they left.
They were probably going to die in prison anyways. Their sentences were so long that they were probably going to die in prison.
Randy may have been the exception. Hi, Randy. He's a great believer in the show and the prison show as well.
Yeah. And
he got married on the prison show.
Oh. All right.
Yeah.
So it's under these circumstances. We had one case last year where Texas executed somebody who was
part of an escape.
Right, who what, a guard was, died.
Popular guard, everybody liked her.
Yeah. And, you know, why did he try? Well, he had nothing to lose. He was staring down a 30 and a 20-year stacked sentence. He had 50 years. He was going to be middle-aged by the time he got out. He had nothing to lose. And so it's...
Why do you think these guys stayed together? And that's a big question in a lot of our minds. We've talked about that around this table, and we're going to talk about it again because there's more of these guys left.
There's a, you know, pure speculation, but one, I thought about that. One, it could be that camaraderie. They wanted to stick together because
kind of a herd instinct.
Yeah. Hey, we got it. We got out of prison together, and we're going to stick together. If one, you know, we're not leaving anyone behind. It could be that. It could also be they. I'm not sure if they really thought about how they were going to make it outside of prison.
They didn't think they were going to make it, and when they did, it's a whole surprise world.
They didn't know what they were going to do.
Jim, you got any speculation on that?
Well, first off, I found real shocking in this particular case. The way they planned this was almost ingenious. They did a hell of a job of planning this prison escape, and they knew the prison system well, extremely well planned. And I kept thinking, how in the world can you plan something that well and then screw it all up by staying together? Because as you and I were talking earlier, had you been part of that seven, about 100 yards out of the
Ray,
you'd say, good luck, guys. Good luck, guys. See you later. I'm going to see my mama, and yeah. I'm out of here.
No, I ain't going to go see my mama, but I know a culvert where I can curl up in.
That's right. And why in the world that they would stay together? Because here's the deal. There's seven of them, or one of them's dead. There's six of them at this point, whose photographs are on television. If they're together, there's a greater possibility someone will recognize one of the six if they're together. If they're separate, perhaps you could disguise that. I couldn't think of any logical reason why in the world they would stay together during that period of time. Unless they thought in their safety in numbers. We don't want somebody telling them, what's it going to tell? I mean, they were already all over television. Why could you tell this public didn't already know? Because sometimes you keep someone near to the vest if they can hurt you in the event you're caught. I don't see that being a factor. I just have no earthly idea unless they thought with a group of them they could do better in robbing. Because, see, they had to have money.
Wait a minute.
Well, it took a whole bunch of people to drag that safe out of Radio Shack. Right. One guy couldn't have done it.
At least one hook and chain on it. Somebody drives a truck.
When they're dragging safes out of businesses, you need about four or five guys to do it. Maybe that was
If you're going to go steal a safe to get the money in it, I can think of better places to do that than Radio Shack.
I can, too. Susan, you're going to say something about when I mentioned the fact that...
The escape was well planned. But what to do after they got out was going to be problematic because they had no money. So, I mean, either they would have to go on a robbery spree to get money as a group or individually.
Well, that was a viable option considering the trades they were in.
Right. Or they would have to have, shall we say, if they split up, they would have to have somebody on the outside that would, shelter them.
They did have some outside help.
That's right.
And he ultimately was tried and sentenced. Right,
right, exactly. As a matter of fact, a father of one of the inmates had set the pickup. They set a car for them. What had happened, they drove away in a prison maintenance pickup, and then they go to Kennedy where a car is waiting on them, and that car was put there by one of the inmates' father.
But I remember it on the news at the time. Do you remember it, Jim?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, of course. It was
yeah,
big
I mean,
stuff.
I remember it
Can
on the
news. Can you imagine what it was like on the prison show having to cover this story?
I mean, at the time, the way I remember it is they were after the prison escape. I want to say it was 2 or 3 weeks. Is that about maybe about 3 weeks before they
we knew after they left Irving, we knew it was them.
Right, right.
Yeah, but then they went to Colorado, and we lost sight of them again.
But I want to say, weren't they apprehended about 3 or 4 weeks late after
No, it's January. The escape occurred on December the 13th, and they're apprehended about somewhere in the middle of January, later January. So they were out over a month and a half. And they were out for some time before they robbed the Carolina.
At any point in there, they had owned a compass, and each of them followed separate points on that compass.
And what I found interesting, too, Ray, when these guys get out, they don't have driver's license. They have no identity. If they'd have got stopped for a traffic ticket.
They actually don't come knock on your door for a traffic ticket.
I understand that, but
you're going to get stopped and asked for your driver's license anyway.
But if seven guys escaped from prison, you see seven guys in a van, an RV, you might stop it and look it over since there's seven, the number.
What I thought was real odd.
After
about,
you know the take from right. from the Oshmans, you might not.
That's right. Well, you may call in the helicopter squad to help you, but you certainly stop them.
What I found real odd about what they did afterwards, and this leads me to suspect that they had not planned on what to do if they were successful. They were so close to the Mexican border.
Yeah,
it would have been so much easier just to go south, hop the border, and. Boom.
Yeah, they're 80 miles from Mexico.
Yeah, not very far in Kennedy County. Yep. And instead, they stuck together. Again, if you're going to stay off the radar, committing crimes is probably not the way to do it.
Here's my theory. George Bush planned his, like Iraq. They're good at overthrowing the government. Had no plans afterwards. My theory is George Bush was behind all of this. Helped him do the planning just like they did in Iraq, but had no earthly idea what the hell to do once it was toppled. And then they messed it up good. So I think George Bush did is my theory.
Rumsfeld said they'll come out and greet us with flowers in the street.
That's exactly right. So I think George Bush was behind all of this. It's about that George Bush thinking.
You know, we talk about laugh. Meanwhile, there's three guys sitting down on the row waiting their turn for their execution, and this is their brother.
I understand.
And I want you guys to know I'm sensitive about that. I went to death row today, and I interviewed Lester Bauer, and he is the one that is scheduled for the next execution broadcast. And that will be videotaped, so everybody wear flowers in your hair for the videotape.
I think Jack's got a special hat to wear. So.
Yeah, and so we've got that all planned out. And
I'll bring mine.
And I also spent some time with Rodney Reed, and Rodney has a lot of followers that listen to this show. In a few minutes we got back, I want to talk to my audience in this show. I am absolutely amazed. The last time we did Execution Watch, we did it on the HD3 channel. According to Otis, who is the wizard that knows such things, we had over 100 live listeners on the internet. The station's broadcast channel had 6. Now, 6 listeners on the internet. Well, sure, it's a lot easier to listen to the broadcast channel like you're listening today than it is to listen to an HD channel on the internet. So you're not as many of you have to listen. But this show is valuable to you, and I want you to know I appreciate your placing a value on this show. I'd also like to remind you that KPFT is in some serious financial straits. And we can only continue the show if KPFT survives those straits. So if you can help in that regard, and you can be a generous donor, please give the station a call during regular business hours, weekdays at 713-526-4000, and offer your help to do that to the management or the membership director or somebody there. We're going to continue to do Execution Watch, and between fundraising times, we're going to do it on the broadcast channel, and I appreciate your listenership. As a matter of fact, I want you to reach out to other people and let them know that every show we have ever done, is awaiting a podcast listenership on the website, www.executionwatch.org. And if those tapes were videotaped because we had an interview from the inmate, that video is there too. You will see some of the people we met in the process of standing by them while they were executed. Guys on death row, I think of you often. I hope we never do another execution watch. But if we do, it will be about my friend Lester Bauer on February the 10th. This is Ray Hill for radio station KPFT in Houston on behalf of Elizabeth Stein. I want to thank Pat Hartwell. I want to thank Jennifer Simpson. I want to thank Jim Skelton and the legal crew of Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, and Jack Lee. And thank you very much for listening. Good night. Don't you know they're killing people? 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 On life, there they're not giving up. Guns to men, will a thousand be enough? On life, and we're not giving up. Killing people. Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people?